Oh, okay, I'll start. So good morning, everybody. Welcome to the third lecture. So maybe you have noticed already that I have uploaded the solution for yesterday's tutorial. So if you couldn't solve the first problem, which is especially important, the null test theorem is very important. It's the most important thing in this course, so please try to understand what's going on there. You will see it many more times. You will see it in quantum field theory. You'll see it in quantum gravity. So you'll see it during the whole year, the whole psi year. But this is basically like the simplest possibly. Yes? Without assuming, sorry? Okay, we can talk about it later. Yeah, let's talk about it later. If you have some other sneaky way how to do that, that's fine. As long as it works. Okay, so today I would like to discuss two advanced topics. So far we had like basic Hamiltonian mechanics. Today is really advanced topics. So first of them is the Hamilton-Jacobi theory, and the second one is about the integrability, integrable systems. But before actually I start doing that, let me briefly recall what we have done yesterday. And love was such an easy game to play. So we realized that in Hamiltonian description, there is a huge freedom. And that freedom is that you are allowed to do so-called canonical transformations. So yesterday, we've seen that we can transform the old coordinates Q and P to some new coordinates, large Q and P. Okay, and so this transformation was called a canonical transformation. So this is canonical. If and only if there exists a new Hamiltonian, and so that the Hamilton's canonical equations are still satisfied. So such that d h prime over dq equals to minus p dot and d h prime over dp equals to q dot. Okay, so that's a huge freedom in your description. And we have seen that such canonical transformations are generated by generating functions. And so, for example, so generating functions function. So, for example, and these are always functions of old and one new coordinate. So the simplest example is that I take small q and big q. So that was the example which we discussed. And then we derive sort of conditions under which this really be the case that we have a canonical transformation that we can find h prime. And the conditions were that small p must be equal to df over dq. Large p must be equal to minus df over d large q. And that the new Hamiltonian is simply the old one plus df over dt. Okay, so these were the conditions which we derived. Let's call this equation C, like a condition. Okay, I also told you that there are many ways how you, yes? I don't know if that question really makes sense. So you're just doing, so you have a concrete system, which means you have a concrete age, and then you are just trying to, simplify your life by doing some coordinates changes. So in practice, I think you have concrete age, and then you are trying to work on that. So I don't know if. if you need this to be true for general. Well, here we haven't specified age, right? But in practice, you always specify age in any concrete problem.
Okay, but
it, it, it yeah, if you can satisfy all these conditions or whatever, then there will be canonical transformations. It may happen that, for example, this generating function for a concrete age, it may happen that this generating function is not good, that you cannot find any, well, that for example, you must consider Q and big P rather than Q and Q, right? So there are some degenerate cases where you cannot, for example, do it with this generating function, but yeah. I also told you that there are actually two ways how you can understand the action. So first of all, you can understand it as a functional of the trajectory. Okay, so this is a function, it's an integral over that, and it's really a function of a function. Or you can understand it if you fix the trajectory already, if you've solved the Euler-Lagrange equations, then you can understand it as a function of the initial time and initial position to some final position and final time. So, and this is valid on shell. So basically you can think about it, well, I already fixed the trajectory and now all I care about is where do I start on the trajectory and where do I finish? Whether I start here or here or here, and where do I finish? So that's another understanding of the function, but this is really on shell. I already know that I'm satisfying Euler-Lagrange equations. And you have seen that if I understand it in this way, then you derive this relation by taking total derivative of this action as a function of Q and T, and you derive these relations. And dS over dt is minus h. We have also seen that this interpretation of the action actually sort of allowed us to eliminate time evolution. So now we can sort of reinterpret time evolution as nothing else, just a canonical transformation. And that canonical transformation will be generated by this function S, so by the action. So there is no time evolution in Hamiltonian mechanics, basically. All you are doing, you can always understand it as a coordinate transformation. Okay, so that was yesterday. So now let me use these results to do this very advanced theory. So part D, and that's called Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So who's familiar with Hamilton-Jacobi theory? Half people say. So that's good. That's almost half. Well, anyway, so there is an ingenious idea behind this theory. So ingenious idea. Since I'm allowed to do all these transformations, these canonical transformations, why not to find such a transformation where my new h prime would be zero? So the idea is, let's find a special generating function. Let's call it again S, because there is not enough letters in the alphabet. Okay, so special generating function S, such that H prime, the new Hamiltonian, equals identically zero. Well, it may be possible, right? So I have this H prime is the old one plus now ds over dt. So if I specify cleverly my s, then I can just eliminate right-hand side. Okay, so that's the idea. So then, of course, I know, so if this is the case, and if I can find such s, then first of all, I can solve immediately my canonical equations, right? So I have just h prime is equal to 0. So dh prime over dq is 0. So I immediately see that p dot is equal to 0, which means p is a constant, right? And the same way, q is a constant, right? So if h prime equals to 0, then from the Hamilton equations, I know that q equals to some constant. Let's call it alpha. And then p equals to another constant. Let's call it minus beta. And then minus is just a convention, which is convenient, which you'll see in a minute. But I just solved the Hamilton equations already, right? So if my Hamilton is 0, then it's no problem to solve them. Okay, so that's one thing. Another thing, if you look at those conditions there, in particular in the middle one, So take this condition C and the middle one, then you have that P is minus dF over dq, right? So that's what it was. So now I call my F to be the special function S. But I know that P is minus beta and Q is alpha. So what it gives you is actually that beta equals to ds, Q and alpha and T over d alpha. Okay. So far, everybody happy? No. So far, it's just a generating function.
Okay. Are we going to eventually choose the action for this?
Yes. That's why you choose again s, right? But at this point, it's just any generating function, which, however, guarantees that my h prime in that condition c is actually 0. So if I can find such a generating function, then I have this result. I can immediately integrate the equations of motion. But I have this condition here, right? So this must be true. OK. But what does it mean? So I have now, so the right-hand side is a function of q, a constant alpha, and t. And the left-hand side is just a constant. So if, so I can invert this, if I can invert this, so this gives q as a function of t, alpha, and beta. If I can invert whatever I have on the right-hand side for q, right? So by inversion, and so I'm done. Everything is solved, right? I found my trajectory as a function of two constants. That's exactly what I needed. I'm done. So the only tiny problem remains how to find this miraculous special function s, right? So if I know this special function s, well, in order to do this, I need to know what s is, right? So I need to know how s is the function of q and alpha so that I can differentiate with respect to alpha, set it equal to some constant beta, and then from there I have a solution. Okay, so how to find, the question is how to find this miraculous function s. But I still haven't used the first relation in the condition. So I know that the first relations, again, the condition which I have is that p is ds over dq. That's the first condition over there. And I also know that h prime is 0, which is h plus ds over dt. OK. So what does it mean? So I know. So h is a function of q, p, and t. But I know what P is. P must be ds over dq. So in other words, this thing here is my equation for s. Okay, so let's write it here. So you have that ds over dt plus h, which is function of q. And instead of p, I write ds over dq. ds over dq, which is basically p. And then t, and this is equal to 0. And this is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It's called HJ, which is Hamilton-Jacobi. And I lost this. Okay, so this is, so now what we have done basically here is that we started with Newton's equations, then we said, okay, this is nice, but let's have another description. Let's have Euler-Lagrange equations. So those were equations which were second order in time, and there were n of them. So then we said, okay, let's go to Hamiltonian's description. Now we double the number of equations, but they are only first order in time. And now what we have done, we've done something even nicer. We have just one equation to solve, and that's all mechanics is captured in this equation, right? But now this equation is actually a partial differential equation. So you traded your mechanical problem to have one partial differential equation for s, right, which has time derivative and q derivatives. But once you solve that, you have solved all your mechanical problem. So, but it's amazing. You have all mechanics in just one equation. Not yet. Not yet. It's just a special function which I need to find. but yeah, it is. It is. Okay. So let me just show. So it's this is just one PDE for S, which is function of Q and T, right? And if I can solve that, then I have solved my problem. So now, why is this action? It's very simple, because you have those relations over there, that ds over dq is p, and ds over dt is h. That's what we've proven once we understood that as is a function of q and t, right? And if you look at that, that's exactly the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. The second thing is ds over dt plus h equals to 0, and I know that in that h, I have to plug for every p, I have to plug ds over dq. So it is indeed the action. Okay, so this is indeed the action when understood as a function of coordinates from this delta. Did I call it delta? No, I didn't. But I call it yesterday delta. So that relation here is a delta relation. Yes? So if I have more coordinates, then this is just ds over dt, just one time. It's still a scalar equation. It's just one equation. But I just put index here. Yeah. H is Hamiltonian, right? So you just, you have your Hamiltonian, which may depend on many q's and many p's, right? And all I have to do is just replace all the p's in that Hamiltonian by this derivative of s. Okay, so now, because it's a PDE, it has many more solutions that we want, right? So what we are interested in is so-called complete integral. I don't know if you studied PDEs. I don't remember almost anything about them. But anyway, so what you are interested in is really this complete integral, which is s as a function of q. Let me put these indices, qj. And then you will have alpha j, which are the constants, and t. So this is what you are after, so that you can actually differentiate these alpha j's and get your solution. Besides this, there is, of course, also a general. So this is what I'm interested in, rather than so-called general integral. General integral. Which is basically an arbitrary function. So if you studied, I don't know, first order PDEs, you would find that the solution of this PDE is basically like an arbitrary function of some special argument or something like that. For example, the wave equation, so the solution of wave equation would be any function which is function of x minus vt or something like that. Okay, so we are not interested in this. You are not interested in the arbitrary function solution. You are interested in the special solution, which depends on these constants. Okay. So now, how to do in practice is that we'll do very sneaky way, and that's called separation of variables. So useful trick. How to solve this is called separation variable separation. Separation of variables, and there are, well, didn't write it here. So there are useful tricks how to find this special complete integral, and in particular, for example, let's assume that h doesn't depend on time explicitly. Then you can show that s, qj, and t. That actually the dependence on time of this s separates away. Okay, so you can find it as S0, which now depends on qj only. And then there is this constant e times t. So you completely separate away the time dependence. Okay. Similarly, if you have a cyclic coordinate, so q-cyclic, if h is independent of some special coordinate, call it q-cyclic, then, again, s qj of t equals to, again, a constant times this coordinate and plus the rest, which doesn't depend on this coordinate anymore. So it's q1. And then QC is missing, and then QN. Okay, so basically, whenever you know there is some symmetry or whatever, you can separate that away. And exactly, so these E and this alpha C are just constants, and they will turn out to be the corresponding integrals of motion in your solution. However, you know, it may happen that you don't see these symmetries, but you can still try a separation ansatz. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So but the trick is to try really the separation ansatz. So where you try to separate all and every coordinate you think about, so then you will call it S1 of Q1 plus S2 and Q2 and so on. Sn and Qn and minus Et if it's independent of function. So you can try this. So this is called additive separation. It's probably double D. Is it double D? It's double D. Additive. Yeah, double D. Additive separation. So this you may try, and it may work, but it's not guaranteed that it will work. But those two first things, they will work if you have cyclic coordinate or if it's independent of time. Yes?
In the case for a cyclic coordinate, where is the time dependence?
It's still here. It's still here. Sorry. It's still here. So this is really alpha and E are constants. It is still there. Whenever your Hamilton is not time dependent, you can always do it like E times T. It's it's a very special case. Okay, so now one warning is that, of course, the separation depends on which coordinates I'm using. So it may happen that your problem is you can separate your problem in one coordinate, for example, Cartesian coordinates, but you cannot separate in spherical coordinates. So this is really a coordinate dependent thing. So coordinate, just a warning, dependent. So some coordinates are better for your description than the other coordinates. Okay, so this is all great. So let me do a very simple example to show you how this terrible machinery actually works in practice. Okay, so the simplest example. And then in your tutorial tomorrow, you will do a much more complicated example. So, and the simplest example is free fall. So I have Hamiltonian, which is just p square over 2m minus plus v, where v is just minus m g times x. Okay, so this is my Hamiltonian. Now I want to write down my Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So anytime I see p, I replace it with derivative of s with respect to q. So my Hamilton-Jacobi equation is now written as 1 over 2m. And now it's ds over dx square, that's p square, plus v of x, and plus ds over dt equals to 0. That's my Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So now I see that my Hamiltonian does not depend on time explicitly, right? So since s is not function, h is not function of time, then I can try to, well, I know that s must be equal to s0 of x minus et. Okay, so if I plug it in, then I get 1 over 2m. Now, this will just be 0 instead of s over dx square plus v minus e equals to 0. Okay, which means that I can solve for s0. So now this is an ordinary differential equation, which I can solve. So from here, I can solve for S0, which will be just an ordinary integral of, if I put this thing on the right-hand side and take a square root, so S0 is a, let's say, plus minus, is that true? Yeah, plus minus an integral 2m e minus v square root of that dx. Okay, I solve this ordinary differential equation to find a zero, and you can actually do that integral if you know what v is, which we know it's just m is linear in x, so you can do this integral and just plug it into mathematical maple, and it will give you the solution hopefully. So then you find that s is 1/3 m square g 2m e plus m gx 3/2 minus et. Okay, so if I do the integral, this is the solution, and this is my full solution for s. Okay, so that's great. I found my special function s. So now all I have to do is actually to find the solution, right? So I have to do this thing. So I have to differentiate it with respect to the constant I have, set it equal to another constant, and find a solution. So in particular, what is my constant? The only constant I have there is this constant e, right? So I have ds over dE, and set it equal to pi beta, another constant, and I claim this is a solution. So now what is this? It's 1 over mg, so I take this expression, I differentiate with respect to e. Well, I never differentiate in public, so I'll just give you the solution. So it's 2m e minus v, and then minus t. I could differentiate this one, right? So that's minus t here. Okay, so that's great. So where is my solution? So this v is hiding x, right? So all I have to do is invert this relation so that I have an expression for x. So what I have to do is I have to take t on the right hand side, on the left hand side, so I have beta plus t multiplied by mg squared that divided by 2m subtract e and so on. So in the end, if you do that, you find that x is just g half t plus beta square minus e over mg by inversion. Just do it yourself. Hopefully you will get the same result. However, this solution is sort of familiar, right? So beta, so now what we know what beta is, it's just a choose of t0, right? So it's just when I start moving, right? So then I recover this g half t square for the free fall in the gravitational field. And moreover, I know what my x0 is, and then that's given by the initial energy I have divided by mg, right? So you see that you have already all constants of integration determined by this process. So it works. It's great. So as I said, this was the simple example. You will do more complicated one in your tutorial tomorrow. Yes?
So, we're talking about S.
Yeah, it's.
Then my thinking is I find that I've got, we've managed to get a P in this formulation of S, whereas if I write down the branching and then get the action, I have P's and Q's in there, and so that means I can't solve the.
Yeah, so it's copied to different object, basically. So you still. So now let me mention very briefly a connection to quantum mechanics. So I'm sure you have taken some introductory course to quantum mechanics. So you know that there's something called Schrödinger equation. And let's be very specific. So it tells you it's an equation for your wave function psi. And this is some Hamiltonian of your evolution and psi. And in the simplest case, this Hamiltonian is just the operator corresponding to p, which is, well, you also say the momentum is the derivative operator. So this will be some operator Laplace square over 2m plus some function of x. So this is all in x representation, if you want. OK, so p here. It's just minus IH gradient with respect to x. Okay, so this you all know. So now what you can do is so-called WKB approximation to this. So WKB approximation. So now you know that this thing sort of describes all quantum fluctuations and stuff like that. So for example, there is nothing like a fixed trajectory. If you want to know, well, I have a particle here and I have a particle there. Is there a fixed trajectory in quantum mechanics which would lead from here to there? But rather, there are some fluctuations. You have many passes which you can go through, and so on. So anyway, so now WKB approximation is semi-classical approximation, where you basically said, well, let's consider that my function, wave function psi, is some constant amplitude times e to h bar s x t. Again, we have s. That's perfect. So there's some, what is it, phase. So now this phase is s again. And then this is just a constant amplitude. OK, so now let me plug that into the Schrödinger equation. So this is my Schrödinger equation. Let me plug the sums out in there. So you have that I h bar b psi over dt. OK, so the only thing which depends on t is this function s. So and then I pick up I over h bar as well. So I and I gives me minus 1. H bar over h bar is just 1. So this is minus ds over dt. And because I have exponential, the psi is still there. OK. And then on the right-hand side, I have this Hamiltonian, which is basically nabla square over 2m plus v. So it's minus 8 square over 2m. Nabla square plus v acting on psi, which is my h psi. But if you calculate it on this function here, on this ansatz here, so basically each nabla will bring me a derivative of s here. But I differentiate twice. So I'll pick up two terms. I will have nabla square term, and then I will have twice nabla dot nabla or something like that. So this is equal to nabla s square over 2m minus. So now what is also important is that each derivative will bring me the factor I over h bar. Okay, so I h bar over 2m nabla square on s plus v, and again I still have psi. Okay, so just do it. I have two terms because I have two derivatives. Very simple. So now all you have to do is take a limit. So take h bar equal to 0 limit, which is where my classical mechanics should be recovered, right? And if you do that, well, what do we have here? We have that minus ds over dt equals to, so now h bar equal to 0 limit kills this term here. And I have this, this is equal to nabla s square over 2m plus v. OK, so what is this? It's a Hamilton-Jacobi equation where my Hamilton is just p square over 2m plus v, right? So this is exactly the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So really, if you set h bar equal to 0, there's this nice transition. It's called a semi-classical approximation. Then, of course, you can expand to high orders in h, and then you will have some corrections to this. But in the first approximation, it's really when h bar equals to 0, you get the classical mechanics as a first approximation to quantum mechanics. So by the way, while we are still here, then of course you already know these Poisson brackets and stuff like that. So then there's a procedure called Dirac's quantization procedure, and basically, so if you start with Q and P, which is the classical mechanics thing, then you assign in this procedure you just assign operators Q hat and P hat. And then the procedure is, so as long as these are canonical variables, you know that they satisfy Qi and Pj. Well, Q and P are equal to 1 classically in terms of the Poisson brackets. And then the procedure is, well, let's replace the Poisson brackets with the commutators, because they satisfy all these fundamental properties as Poisson brackets do. So they are linear, they are anti-symmetric, they satisfy the Jacobi identity and so on. So it's basically like the same object, the Poisson bracket. If you turn these guys to operators, they are sort of like matrices or operators. So I just replace this thing with Q hat and P hat, okay? And then instead of one, you just add there this H bar, and then you add I or something like that. And so this is a general procedure. It's called Dirac quantization procedure. Of course, it's not guaranteed to work, but it works in very many cases. So if you know the classical description of your nature, you can sort of guess what the true quantum description could be just doing this replacement. But of course, it's not guaranteed the other way is the right way. So if you knew the quantum description, you can go in some approximation to a classical description. So this procedure is not guaranteed, but it's used very often and it works in very many cases. Okay, questions to Hamilton-Jacobi equation? Yeah? There are many examples. Well, in quantum field theory, I think you will take maybe one approach you will take is this Dirac quantization of the fields, and you will see there are many problems. And also in quantum gravity course, if you'll take that course, then there will be. So this Hamilton-Jacobi theory is very, very, you know, very nice theory, very advanced topic, but the main advantage of this is that all you have to solve really is just one equation. So it's a partial differential equation. Okay, so now let me go to the other topic, which is even more advanced. So par E. And let's call it integrable systems. And what I will assume in this section is that the phase space is 2n dimensional. So okay. Dimension of the phase space is 2n. Okay, and we can call the phase space M. Well, doesn't matter. So now let me start with a definition. So we have already seen Liouville's theorem in the at the end of the last lecture. So Liouville was a very important person for Hamiltonian mechanics, and so there is another theorem, which is Liouville's integrability theorem, which has nothing to do with the previous theorem. But it's just one person was very important. So anyway, so the dynamical system is completely, or Liouville, integrable. If it possesses n independent so independent, I will explain a little bit later what it means. Conserved quantities or integrals of motion. Quantities these. Let's call them F instead of I. So that just to confuse you. QP. And so of course these are conserved along the motion. So this is my function, phase-space function, and this is just the value it takes. So I don't know, the energy equals to zero. So for that will be Fi will be zero, something like that. or the angular momentum takes 5 or whatever. So this is just the value of that. So there exist these n independent conserved quantities. And so because they are conserved quantities, they have to pass some commute with the Hamiltonian, right? But there's an additional condition, is that all these quantities, they have to be so-called in involution. So in involution, so what that means is that the Poisson brackets of any two of them must be 0. So fi and fj equals to 0 for all I and j. So that's a definition of what a completely integrable system means. Okay. So now, why we care? It's because there is a theorem due to Liouville and that says that the solution of equations of motion of a completely integrable system is obtained, and there is this strange word, is obtained by quadrature. So what that means is that you can obtain the solution by a finite number of steps where you only integrate or do some algebraic operations. So there is a finite number of integrations and algebraic operations. Algebraic operations. Okay, so that's the theorem, and I will sort of prove it to you. But first, let me explain what it means and what this complete integrability, what the terms are there, and so on. Yes.
Is that the theorem that you don't have
So if you don't have enough integrals of motion, you simply cannot find the solution, basically. Okay. So let me do first remarks and then proof of this theorem so that we know what we are talking about. And then, okay. So remarks. And the first remark will be rather lengthy, and it's called 1/2 rule. Oh, I call it 1/2 rule. Okay. So why do I call it 1/2 rule? Is that, this is not what I wanted. So I just want to stress this really. So we have a phase space, which in this section has dimension 2n. So I have n generalized momenta and n generalized coordinates. So I have 2n variables which I need to solve for, basically. Okay. However, in this theorem, I am saying is that you need only 1/2 integrals of motion. You need only n integrals of motion. So you need actually only 1/2 than you would expect. So, and this is a special property of Hamiltonian systems. Okay. So, in general, to integrate. Two n first order ODEs, which is, for example, the Hamiltonian description I have, so canonical equations, two n ODEs, we must know must know 2n, first integrals of motion, or constants of motion, okay, constants of motion. Well, it's very simple because the solution Q depends always on constants, right? So I need really 2n constants of motion to integrate 2n ODEs. Okay? So, however, I'm saying is that Hamiltonian system is special. All I need is half. Just need half. One half of that, and that's a very special property, right? So what does it mean is actually that if I have only n integrals of motion instead of 2n, somehow miraculously I have to use each integral twice to integrate my motion, right? So in other words, each integral can be used twice. Or if you want, it reduces the order of the system by two. Okay, but anyway, I can use each integral twice. Okay, so before I explain this a little bit, or maybe I'll not explain it, I want you to notice a similar statement which you will encounter in quantum field theory course. So analogous statement, which is not exactly the same statement, but it's a very useful statement. Okay, so analogous statement in QFT. Well, basically, it is the same statement. And that says, and that's a formula which you should carry from this course because it's a very useful formula. So, in any gauge field theory, you have true degrees of freedom. And they set a number of these true degrees of freedom, so which are contained in that field theory. So the number of these degrees of freedom equals to the number of apparent degrees of freedom. Minus, and why I talk about it is this magical number 2. Twice number of the degrees of freedom of the gauge function. So this is amazingly nice and amazingly important formula, which you will see in your QFT course many times. But it's basically the same thing as this thing here. I can use every degree of freedom of the gauge function twice. So I need only half gauge functions to kill my degrees of freedom. So now what this means, so give me an example so that this explains. Okay, let's do it here. Sorry? Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Yes. Yes. That's why I talk about it. What do I mean by? If there exists a Hamiltonian which describes my motion, then this will be true. Not for everything. So, for example, maybe you've heard about Davide Gaiotto. Davide Gaiotto, who is a faculty here at PI. So he constructed a large number of quantum field theories, but these don't have Lagrangian description. Nobody knows the Hamiltonian or Lagrangian how to describe these theories. So not always you can formulate everything in terms of the Hamiltonian. So simple examples of this. So example, what this statement means. Example, and take the simplest gauge theory which you know, which is electromagnetism, right? So in electromagnetism, you know that the electromagnetic field is described by four quantities, which are the vector and scalar potential. Okay, so you know that you can describe the electromagnetic field by the vector potential A and by the scalar electrostatic potential phi. Okay, so apparently there are, so apparent, there are 4 degrees of freedom in the electromagnetism, in electrodynamics. However, you also know there is something which is called gauge transformation. So you can actually change phi to phi plus derivative of any function of lambda. And you can change the vector potential to A plus nabla of lambda, where lambda is just any function. And if you do this gauge transformation, then field strength so leaves. The field strength leaves E's and B's invariant. Yeah, maybe there's a minus sign here. Okay, let's put minus sign here. Doesn't really matter. Okay, yeah, there should be one minus sign. Okay, so this you all know. So nowadays, this lambda is called a gauge function. Gauge function. But it's just a function, so it is just, you know, one thing. It's not a vector. It's just so this gauge function, you would say, has 1 degree of freedom because it's a function. Okay. So now, using our magic formula, so how many degrees of freedom electromagnetism has is the apparent ones are just the potentials is 4. However, minus times time 1, which is 2 degrees of freedom. So what are these? They correspond to the polarizations of the photon. So you may have polarization like that, or polarization like that. Or you may have, let's say, circular polarization, where you are circling the right side or to the left side. Right? So these are 2 polarizations of photon. And this is the true degree of freedom which you have in the electromagnetism. Okay, so I may have, let's say, this motion or this polarization, or I can have circular polarization like that, or circular polarization like that, and so on. Okay, so that's the 2 degrees of freedom in electromagnetism. So now, let me do one more example. It will be a little bit more complicated. It's gravity. So we will learn all this in 3 weeks' time. But before you do, let me just mention the result. So another example is gravity. You will learn, as I said, 3 weeks' time, that gravity is described by the metric chi mu nu. So these are just the indices like A and B. But in gravity, it's very particular, so that you start from 0, and then 1, and 2, and 3. So each index mu and nu, they take 4 values. And so this is a matrix, which is 4 by 4. But moreover, this matrix is special. It's symmetric. So if you exchange mu and nu, then you get the same thing, which is so 4 by 4 symmetric So now, how many components is a 4x4 symmetric matrix? 10. So we have, that means that we have 10 apparent degrees of freedom. Also, what you will learn very soon is that there is a similar thing as a gauge transformation in gravity. So there's a gauge transformation, which basically looks very similar to this thing. So you are taking the old field plus some derivative of some gauge function. So that gauge transformation is that I go from g mu nu to g mu nu plus nabla mu psi nu plus nabla nu psi mu. Okay, so these are just derivatives. And then there's this gauge function here, which is now a vector. So it has four components. Okay, so this guy has four components, 4 degrees of freedom. Okay, so it's very similar to what you do in electromagnetism. But now you have, instead of one index, you have like two indices. So it's a little bit more complicated, but very similar. So now what it means is that number of degrees of freedom is the apparent one, which is 10, minus 2 times the gauge function, it's 4, which is 2. So again, you get two polarizations of the graviton. So two graviton polarizations. Okay, and then, well, so basically your graviton either, so if a gravitational wave passes through this place, it either squeezes things like that, or it squeezes them like that, 45 degrees stretched. So you have polarization either like that, or you have polarization 45 degrees twisted. But anyway, but there are just two degrees of freedom in gravity. So you see how much you overkill that, right? So in order to describe 2 degrees of freedom, I am using an object which has 10 degrees of freedom. So I'm really overkilling the statement. But this electromagnetism, you are doing the same thing. You have only 2 degrees of freedom, but every description in terms of phi and A, or even E and B, and then you have 6 of them, right? You have E is 3 and B is 3. So yeah. So that's the feature of any gauge theory, that you overkill that. Well, of course, yeah. There are reasons why to do that, but I'm just saying it's an overkill. Okay. So that was one half rule. Now I promised I will tell you what independent means. So remark number 2 is independence okay. So now let's introduce some geometrical description to this thing. So I have my phase space, which is of course higher dimensional, but let's say there's a P here, there's a Q here. It must be an even dimensional space. I draw it like 3-dimensional, but that's very wrong, but anyway. So, and then I have these integrals of motion, fi, here, and they are just equal to constant. So there are some function of q and p equal to constant. So now from geometrical point of view, what is this equation? So some function of q and p is equal to a constant. Exactly. It's some kind of hypersurface in my phase space. Okay. So each integral fi defines a plane or defines a hypersurface in the phase space. And of course, because during the motion, well, fi is a constant. You know, the motion must lie inside the hypersurface, right? I cannot leave that hypersurface because that will be a different constant of motion. So I would have to change the energy, for example. Okay, so dynamical trajectory, must remain in this surface. I cannot hop from one energy to another because energy is conserved during my motion. Okay, so very bad picture. Oh no, doesn't matter. So this is my hypersurface, which tells me, let's say, okay, F1 Q and P equals to F1, for example, equals 0 or something like that. So this will be my hypersurface, which will be defined by that, and my trajectory always have to lie on that hypersurface. Okay. So now imagine that I have two of these integrals. So then if there is another integral, it will define another hypersurface. Okay, so I will have another hypersurface here, which goes like that, for example, and then it cuts it here, cuts it here. Okay, so this is the intersection of the two hyperplanes. Okay. So this is F2 equals to F2. So in general, these hypersurfaces will be different. And I know that if both things must be imposed simultaneously, which means if F1 and F2 are conserved at the same time, then the motion actually must be at the intersection of these two hyperplanes, right? So the motion now must lie on this line if both integrals are to be conserved. So there's this M, F1, and F2, which is now, the motion must be there. So if two integrals are actually to be conserved. Okay, so now what independent means in that formula, so that you have to have n independent integrals of motion, is basically that these hypersurfaces are never tangent. If they were tangent, they are never tangent. So really, their intersection has the full dimensionality you want. Okay, so independent means that hypersurfaces are never tangent. So you can say, well, there are basically two same integrals of motion when they define the same hypersurface locally. Right, so then they wouldn't be independent because it's the same hypersurface. Okay, or in other words, if M of F, and by M of F I mean F1, F2, F3, and so on, has the full possible dimensionality you want. So M of F given by Fi equals to Fi has dimension, and what is the dimension? Full dimension? Really? Okay, so here I have, let's say I have 4D phase space, So I have two Qs and two Ps. So now I have two integrals of motion. So each of them defines one hypersurface. So now what is the dimension of that intersection? It's two-dimensional, right? So it has dimension n. So basically you are going from two n-dimensional phase space to an n-dimensional common space, MF, where the motion has to take place, right? You have n integrals of motion. Is this clear? Okay, so that's the geometrical interpretation. So that's what independent means, that the hypersurfaces really intersect, they are never tangent. Okay, so that was a shorter remark. Now, even shorter remark than that one is that I'll just say that because Hamiltonian, because all these FIs are constants of motion, the Hamiltonian Poisson commutes with them, right? So now we can show that actually because the Poisson bracket is non-degenerate and you have already n integrals which all mutually commute, then actually Hamiltonian must be function of all these integrals already. So if you have n integrals, f1 to fn, then the Hamiltonian is just an expression which is a function of all these. Okay, so non-degeneracy of Poisson bracket implies that actually if you have n independent integrals of motion f1 to fn, then the Hamiltonian is already either one of them, for example, or it's just some function of them. So it's not an independent thing. Okay. So that's a remark three. That's a trivial remark. So usually what happens is that Hamiltonian is just take F1 to be Hamiltonian, and then you have additional integrals of motion. Non-degeneracy. Yeah. It. Do you want to? No. I'll try to explain it tomorrow when I talk a little bit about symplectic geometry. But yeah. So now, this is an interesting remark. So now I'll try to convince you that all completely integrable systems basically look like a harmonic oscillator. Okay, so that's an interesting statement. So under suitable global hypothesis, you can show that this MF, where actually the motion takes place, is n-dimensional, looks like an n-dimensional torus. Tori Tn. Okay. So instead of going to a proof or something like that, let's just have a feeling for that. So let's discuss an example. And this will be a harmonic oscillator. So harmonic oscillator. So H is 1/2. I set mass equal to 1. P square plus omega square Q square. Yes? Yeah. Okay. So if I draw a picture in the phase space, I have P and Q and P. So then this thing, because the energy is conserved here, so for each motion, this is a constant. So it's an ellipse in the phase space, right? So the motion actually has to lie on an ellipse in the phase space. So H equal to E, which is a constant, is an ellipse. So now ellipse is almost a torus. Well, it is a torus. Okay, so this corresponds to T1. And how you can see that is that I can, you know, change coordinates from P and Q to something else. So I can introduce new coordinates, rho and theta. Basically, I will measure the distance up to here, and then I will measure the angle where I am on that ellipse. So if you change coordinates, so introduce new coordinates rho and theta, which are given cosine theta and q. I want to kill the ellipse. I want to make it a circle. So I'll absorb this omega there. So it's rho over omega sine theta. And then the motion, in the phase space is nothing else than that rho is a constant, is the radius of the circle, is given by the energy I consider. And then theta is omega t plus theta 0. So basically, in these coordinates, well, whatever. So theta is something like this theta, right? So I just circle around here, and the meaning of rho is that I rescale it so that I'm on a circle. That doesn't matter. So it just tells me how big the circle is. That is the meaning of rho, and where on the circle I am. And so the radius of the circle is determined by the energy, and then this is just a linear function of the frequency omega, which appears in my Lagrangian. I just circle around. Okay, so now these two variables, rho and theta, yes? Exactly. You would have a two-dimensional torus, and then you would have two angles, which will tell you where on that, on each of the. So you will have like two circles, one circle and another circle, and then you have two angles, which will tell you where on the circle you are. Exactly. Exactly. So these are called action angle variables. Action angle variables. And the statement is that any integrable system has this structure. So you can really always have a torus. And then and the shape of the torus is sort of like the action variable. And then you have the angles on the torus, on the angles on the circle. That's the angle variable here. So now, slight generalization of this. So this was just harmonic oscillator in one dimension. So small generalization is that I have multidimensional oscillator, which is just 1/2, and now I have sum over I pi square plus omega I square qi square. Okay. So now if you can bring your system into this form, then each of these things, so for each I have separately conserved quantity fi. So fi are n conserved quantities. And you can show that they are in involution. In involution. And then you can do the same trick as you did for 1, then now you can do for n. Okay, so now I have n circles and n angles. And that gives me the torus. So in this case, MF is just where this is FI equals to FI. Fixing the energies for each of them is a torus, TN. And the statement is that all integrable systems basically can be brought into this form. Look like this. For example, the Kepler problem is an integrable system, and I'm saying it's basically like a multidimensional harmonic oscillator. Okay? So that's remark 4. Oh no. Now, remark 5 is that why Hamilton-Jacobi theory is interesting and important is that once you formulate Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and you can separate the variables in that equation, completely separate variables, and you can find S, then you already know that your system is completely integrable. That's a statement, an interesting statement. So remark number 5 is, if Hamilton-Jacobi equation is separable, then motion is completely integrable. So that's why Hamilton-Jacobi theory has, you know, very important plays very important role for completely integrable systems, right? So once I can separate that, I know I have won the lottery and my system is integrable. And there are not so many integrable systems in nature, but they are very important. Okay. Finally, remark number six is that it may happen that your system is not necessarily completely integrable, but it's very close to an integrable system. And then there's this famous KAM theorem. So for small perturbations of integrable systems, and you know, this is all very vague, what small means and so on. The statement is that the Liouville, so this is also sometimes called Liouville tori. Again, Liouville, important guy. So the tori exists almost everywhere. And KAM theorem deals with this. So for example, you have a motion in central field, so you have a Kepler motion, and it may happen that you have some additional planet or whatever disturbing your system a little bit, perturbing your system a little bit. So the statement is, and this is called quantify, this KAM theorem quantifies what is small perturbation and stuff like that, but the statement is that the motion is sort of will still be completely integrable, at least in some regions. And this leads to the whole chapter, which is called deterministic chaos and so on. Deterministic chaos. And there's a whole discipline behind these perturbations of integrable systems, which of course we don't have time to do here. But anyway, if you're interested, by the way, this A stands for Arnold, which is that book I recommended. Okay, so we have 5 minutes. Perfect. So now I'll prove this theorem to you. Well, not really, but I'll try. But of course, omitting all the important steps, just giving you the idea of the proof. Idea of proof. And the idea is very simple. So what we want to do is we want to find, so want a canonical transformation, which you already know well enough, which goes from the original coordinates qi and pi, or pj, let's call it, doesn't matter, to some new coordinates, where these guys will be exactly the integrals of motion which appear in the theorem. So these guys are the conserved quantities. Exactly. So these are the conserved quantities, the integrals which we already have, and these are the angles on the tori, basically. So if you can find such a canonical transformation which goes from my original coordinates to this thing here, then fi dot, which is h and fi equals to what? Zero, because we have integrals of motion. Psi i dot, which is h and psi I, equals to, now if I use the canonical expression for this bracket in terms of variable phi, f and psi, then it says dh over d fi. You are wondering about this? Maybe there's a minus thing. Okay, but I showed you that h is a functional, it's a constant, but it's a function of these fi's. But they are all constant, right? So this thing is simply some new constant, which is just a function of the previous constants, right? There's no other way. So this is a constant. So what it means is that I can integrate this size, right? I can integrate this equation. It's just psi rho equals to a constant. So psi I of t is psi I at 0 plus omega I times t, right? So that's precisely what you expect from this angle thing. So yeah, just moving on that circle around this angle. So if I can do this, I have solved and find action angle variables. And then we have solution of the problem. So this is one thing, and the other one is constant. So fi is 0. That's my solution. Fi is constant. Fi is constant. So that's the solution of my problem. So if I can find such a canonical transformation which goes from q's to f and psi, then I'm done. Okay?
Constant meaning is in not being a function of time.
Meaning that if you do total derivative with respect to time. But anyway, any energy is like, I don't know, 5 joules, right? It's 5. Okay. So you need to find, of course, if this were true, you need to find the corresponding generating function. So what is the generating function? Generating function. Okay. It's again called S. Sorry for that. So anyway, so it's just a generating function. So you know that there is this space, the restrictive space where your motion has to take place, fi equals to fi. Okay, so that's my restrictive space. It's the intersection of all these hypersurfaces, right? However, this fi is a function of q and p. So on this space, I can actually invert this relation. So this thing here, this is just a number. This is some function of q and p. And I can solve it for p, right? So solve this. So invert this, invert, to get that pi is a function of f and q, right? Which I can definitely do on this space MF, right? So this is fi, q, and p equals to something. In principle, I can invert that. I can solve for p, this thing here. OK, so on MF. On MF. OK, and then I can define function s, which will be function of q and f. Okay, so it will be generating function of the old coordinate and the new coordinate. And I define this to be an integral from q0 to q, where I fix this q0, pi dqi. Okay, a fixture. So there is a huge phase space, p and q and many other things. And then I already know that there is an intersection of all these hypersurfaces where my motion has to take place. So let's just draw this intersection now. So this is M of F. Okay. And you know that motion must occur in this hypersurface, which is n-dimensional. Okay. So now I fixed, let's say, Q0 here, and I start the motion here, and that's fixed. And then I want to go by some trajectory to q, and I'll integrate pi along that trajectory. So this is like a path integral. Well, I'm going along this trajectory from q0 to q, and I'm integrating pi. But pi is a function of f and q. So in the end, everything is function of q and f only. Okay. Okay, so now this is my integral. So now if this exists, then, and I deleted that. No, I still have that. That's perfect. I'm looking at that C conditions for the canonical transformation. I know that, staring at the middle one again, so I know that the new momenta, psi j, are minus ds over dfj. Okay, so this is how I define my S, and then once I have S, I have all, I know how to find all the new coordinates. I know how to find size, and I proclaim that the other set of coordinates is F. Okay, so now I found the transformation. Okay, so now the only problem, this is a sum of all these things. Okay, so if I define S, and if this is well defined, and if it exists, then I solve the problem. So now the only thing is to prove that it exists. And so what does it mean is that really what is on the right hand side is indeed, as I claim on the left hand side, function of Q and F only. Okay. In other words, you have to prove that if I take another path, then it will be independent of that path, because otherwise it's not well defined. It wouldn't be function of q only; it will be function of the path I go. So, in order to complete the proof, you need to show that this is independent of the path, and that's where the other condition actually enters. So, you need to have this involution thing, and if you have the involution, then you can show that this integral is independent of paths. So if this exists, so it must be independent of paths, independent of the path I go, and this is if and only if you have the involution. So that's why you have the involution requirement in the theorem as well. So this is one of the most difficult theorems, actually, in Hamiltonian mechanics. So now you all know it, and now we even know how to prove it. Okay, so it's great. It's really, really, really advanced stuff. But the theorem says that we have to obtain a solution of equations of motion by this quadrature, right? By finite number of integrations and algebraic operations. But this proof actually gives you it shows you explicitly how to do that, right? So all I have to do, in principle, is that I have to do some algebraic operations to invert these relations, fi equals to fi, for p, right? So that's the finite number of algebraic operations I have to do. And then I have to do one integration to find s. Okay, so that's an explicit proof of this. Okay, so we obtain the solution of the equations of motion by doing these algebraic operations, inverting fi equal to fi, and by doing one integral. So this proof is very nice because it's instructive as well. Okay, so let me stop here, and tomorrow we'll do some simple things. Not really.